Chevrolet.
May it please the court, I'd like to reserve 3 minutes. My name is John Moore. I'm here representing Michael Nuri and Good Chevrolet, defendants in the court below and the employer in this case. We're asking that the trial court's decision be reversed and that this court order the trial court to compel David Beer to submit to the arbitration agreement that he read and that he initialed and that he signed. Standard of review is de novo for this court. The burden remains on David Beer because he is the party opposing the arbitration. I'll address David Beer's arguments in turn, and I'll go quickly through the first one, which is a constitutional argument that this agreement deprives him of a jury trial. This argument has been made before. It's been rejected by the Washington Supreme Court in the case of Adler. Here, Beer initialed next to a provision which read, quote, "The employee and the dealership voluntarily waive their right to bring a suit in a court of law and have their claims heard by a judge or jury." David Beer initialed next to that. This was a knowing waiver. The agreement does not violate Washington's Constitution. In all the cases, one of the first lines when the courts go into the legal authority is that Washington favors arbitration. There's a strong presumption in favor of it, and they are presumed valid unless there is a basis in contract law for revoking them. David Beer attacks the agreement for being procedurally unconscionable and for being substantively unconscionable. As to the procedural unconscionability, the best case is Zuber. That's 153 Wynn 2D 293. In Zuber, the court found that the agreement at issue was an adhesion contract. Good Chevrolet does not concede that this was an adhesion contract, but Zuber is still informative. What Zuber said is, yes, it's an adhesion contract, but that alone, requiring an employee to sign an arbitration agreement as a condition of employment, does not make it procedurally unconscionable. In Zuber, the court looks at the agreement and says Zuber had a reasonable opportunity to consider the terms, and two, the terms were disclosed. This is what we have here. Beer was handed the agreement. He had an opportunity to review it. He initialed it. He signed it. In the briefing, there's claims that Good Chevrolet, quote, forced or ordered him to sign, but there's no evidence of that. There is an affidavit from Beer that says words to the effect of, here, you need to sign this, that a Good Chevrolet employee said that to him. That does not make the agreement procedurally unconscionable, and the case for that is Zuber. David Beer goes after a number of provisions in the agreement for being substantively unconscionable. Good Chevrolet's position is that if you look at this agreement, Clerk's Paper 65, there's nothing in it that is monstrously harsh, shocking to the conscious, or overly one-sided. It's a pretty fair agreement. The cost-sharing provision, there's nothing one-sided about it. In fact, it favors Beer. If Beer prevails at arbitration, pays nothing. The reference to the repealed statute doesn't make it shocking to the conscience. And that's because the agreement itself, a one-pager with no fine print, lays out the rules to be used at the arbitration. And the rules laid out are similar to the civil rules, what you would have in a bench trial. Good Chevrolet is not picking an arbitrator and forcing David Beer to submit to that arbitrator's decision. The parties are going to have to mutually agree to selecting a retired Washington judge or federal judge, and then that person will serve as the arbitrator. I'm going to go quickly in order to get to my conclusion, but the agreement is mutual, and the agreement does not limit Beer's rights to attorney's fees, and my support for that is the agreement itself, Clerk Paper 65. David Beer is trying to convince this court that there is a trend and coming from the Washington Supreme Court that should convince this court to strike this agreement down. There is no such trend, and Good Chevrolet is comfortable with the cases coming out of the Washington Supreme Court. They start in 2013. I'm not going to go through all of them, but I'll go through two. One is Gandy. You've got to look at the facts of that case and compare it to this one. In Gandy, the court looks at the agreement itself and the fact that plaintiff in Gandy had a small claim, $3,500, and the agreement in Gandy would force her to arbitrate in California. There was also a loser pay provision, and the statute of limitations was shortened. We don't have that here. Here, Beer is claiming a $95,000 annual loss. This claim is going to be much higher, in the range of $700,000. The arbitration will occur in Western Washington. The cost-sharing provision favors Beer, and there's nothing about statute of limitations in the agreement. Good Chevrolet's position is that there are no unconscionable provisions and that the agreement should be enforced in full. However, if the court finds that there are unconscionable provisions, we would ask that those be severed from the agreement. In conclusion, and reserving a little time for rebuttal, I think as in most cases, the facts are important here. And the most important fact is the agreement itself at Clerk's Paper 65. This agreement does not contain any fine print. It is easy to read. The cost-shifting provision in it favors Beer. The rules are laid out. Beer had time to read this. He initialed it. He signed it. Thereafter, Beer works for Good Chevrolet for 7 months, and he earns $110,000. And now, David Beer is trying to back out of the contract that he entered into. He should not be allowed to do that. Contract is not dead in Washington. The agreement ought to be forced, and for the reasons stated here, we're asking that this court order the trial court to compel David Beer to submit to the arbitration agreement that he read, initialed, and signed. Thank you.
Thank you. Good morning.
Morning.
May it please the court, I'm Erin Norgard, and I represent the respondent plaintiff in this case, Mr. David Beer. Against the backdrop of a strong state and federal public policy favoring arbitration agreements and a general presumption of validity, Mr. Beer recognizes that he has a tough challenge in front of him to establish for this court that the arbitration agreement that he signed in this case should not be enforced. But as this court is well aware, arbitration agreements are neither absolute nor impenetrable. And this court has the ultimate responsibility to determine whether or not an arbitration agreement is valid.
With respect to the claim that this agreement is procedurally unconscionable, the standard is lack of meaningful choice. Do you agree?
I agree.
Where in the record is there evidence that he did not have a meaningful choice to either sign or not sign the agreement?
Right. Well, the limited facts that are contained in the record in this case indicate and I guess this is where the facts in this case are meaningfully distinct from the vast majority of the cases in which the employment contract is presented or the arbitration agreement is presented to the employee either at the outset of the employment or as part of the offer of employment. In this case, Mr. Beer was offered and accepted employment by Good Chevrolet. In fact, he was recruited by Good Chevrolet from an existing position at a different dealership, which he quit in order to accept the terms of the employment at Good Chevrolet. It wasn't until 10 days after he had actually started working for Good Chevrolet that Good Chevrolet presented him with the arbitration agreement, according to his declaration that he was told he had to sign it. The reasonable and rational inference from that is that you must sign this as a continuing condition of your employment.
Well, that's what the declaration appears to say, but where does this record reflect any evidence that he did not have the opportunity to ask questions about the agreement, right, to confer with counsel about the agreement?
Correct. And again, we have the limited declaration of Mr. Beer, which indicates he was given a copy of this on his desk. He was told he needed to sign it. What's also missing is any, you know, counterfactual declaration.
Well, it's your burden. And so my question is, tell me what the evidence is to support the burden you must achieve.
The evidence is Mr. Beer's declaration that states he showed up to work 10 days after he had started, found this on his desk, did what he was told, and he signed the agreement.
And that's it?
That's correct. He was never explicitly told, you have an opportunity to seek counsel to go over these terms of the agreement. It's on your desk. You need to sign this.
Is there any case that says that the employer has to tell you that you have the right to seek counsel or you have the right to ask questions?
No, I'm not aware of it. And again, as I'm sure this court is aware, having heard a number of these cases, these are incredibly fact and circumstance specific to the case at hand. But no, I'm not aware of any case that says an employer has to affirmatively state that. It is just one factor that this court can consider. Another issue that arises relates to the procedural surprise as to the ambiguity as to which set of substantive laws are going to govern the disputes that arise under this agreement. Now, the agreement in this case incorporates RCW 7.04 as the governing law of this agreement. RCW 7.04 was repealed in 2005, 7 years before the parties signed this agreement in 2014. Now, nearly 12 years after that case, or after those statutes have been repealed and replaced by a different set of statutes. Now, this is problematic for two reasons. The first reason is it undermines any rational or reasonable argument that Mr. Beer had a meaningful choice as to this particular choice of law provision when he signed an agreement in which his employer asserted a reference to a statute that had been then at that time repealed for about 7 years. To expect an average employee in Mr. Beer's position to fully understand and appreciate the consequences of agreeing to a choice of law that was then non-existent and had been for 7 years is completely unreasonable and, frankly, fundamentally unfair. Just the ability for the average individual who's not skilled at legal research or perusing legislative history to even have the opportunity to Google a set of repealed statutes to see what specific choice of law he or she is agreeing to renders this unconscionable. The procedural ambiguity, the procedural surprise as to what statutes an arbitrator is going to apply 7 years later, or 12 years later. Is the arbitrator going to apply RCW 7.04, which again has now been repealed for 12 years and replaced with a completely different statute? And I would submit to this court that there are significant public policy implications in compelling an employee to proceed with an arbitration under a set of laws that are essentially non-existent. Additionally, again, 7.04A, which is the statute that replaced 7.04, isn't certainly going to apply. By the terms of that statute, they don't apply to employment agreements, and the parties didn't specifically bargain to apply the terms and conditions or the provisions of that statute to their arbitration agreement. So the ambiguity that is fundamentally underlying this entire arbitration agreement renders it unconscionable.
Could an arbitrator conclude that even though 7.04 had been repealed, it could still apply? Because it's a contractual matter here?
Possibly. But again, it goes back to my original argument that ultimately having an employer insert a long repealed statute into an employment agreement, again, undermines the true meaningful choice that the employee had when he signed that agreement. I think it would be difficult. And again, I think that there are public policy implications in compelling an employee to proceed with an arbitration under those circumstances. Shifting to the arguments regarding substantive unconscionability, I want to focus on two key provisions in my argument today. The first is the provision that relates to the right to an attorney and the allocation of the costs for those attorneys. The arbitration agreement in this case states that both the employee and the dealership shall have the right to an attorney at his, her, or its own expense. The language then proceeds to state that the dealership will waive its rights to an attorney if the employee does so as well. Now, at the outset, this is clearly an attempt to extract a waiver of an important right to counsel, which clearly sets up the employer to be at an advantage in any arbitration agreement.
How does it do that?
Well, by telling the employee, you have a right to a lawyer, but it's going to cost you money. But listen, if we go forward and you waive your right to a lawyer, then we'll waive ours as well. I mean, that is a not so subtle inducement of, here are the consequences of you having a lawyer, and here's the benefit to you. If you waive that, we won't have a lawyer as well.
Well, the person would still have a choice to determine whether he or she wish to have a lawyer or not. I don't see how that compels anything.
Well, again, by stating that the right to a lawyer is conditioned on you paying for that lawyer and then subtly indicating that, you know, we'll waive our right to a lawyer if you waive yours. Again, I think that that is an attempt to extract a waiver of the right to a lawyer. But more problematic is the fact that, as the defense argues, the later unrelated provision in the statute, which affords the plaintiff the right to all remedies afforded by statute, counsel argues that that ultimately allows, that general language ultimately allows a prevailing plaintiff in an employment discrimination case to recover statutory attorney fees, even though the previous statement in the agreement seems to contradict that. If that's the case, then I think this court should be incredibly troubled by the fact that the earlier inducement, or i.e. the representation that you can have a lawyer but you'll have to pay for it, that's a misrepresentation, ultimately, of the plaintiff's ultimate ability to recover attorney's fees if he or she prevails in this matter. And that's incredibly disconcerting in light of the fact that this provision is unconscionable either way. It either deprives the plaintiff, a prevailing plaintiff in an employment discrimination case, to recover statutory attorney fees as he or she would in a civil action, or if it does allow that, then it fundamentally misrepresents that earlier language in the statute where it tells the employee, you can have a lawyer, but you have to pay for that lawyer yourself. And either way, that's a problematic. Now, quickly regarding the cost-splitting provision, I would agree that at first glance, this appears to be fairly even.
Is there any evidence in the record showing what the expenses would be?
There isn't. And
isn't that your burden to show that a cost-sharing provision is unconscionable?
That's correct. However, I would point out to the court that the language in this agreement, that the parties shall evenly bear the, quote, cost and expenses without any further explanation or definition of what those costs and expenses include, make it virtually impossible for Mr. Beer to establish by any measure that the cost of an arbitration would be prohibitively expensive. How can we expect Mr. Beer to demonstrate that cost prohibition if he has no idea what costs and expenses are to be included? It just says costs and expenses. Does that include the cost of the arbitrator? Does that include the cost of discovery? Does it include reasonable attorney's fees, which there's no limitation on that as ever? There's simply no way for Mr. Beer to demonstrate to this court that he has the inability to pay those costs and expenses because he doesn't know what they are. I would ask this court to affirm. Thank you.
Real quickly, as to procedural unconscionability, Clerk's Paper 77 through 79 is it. This is the affidavit of Beer. The key line is David Beer says that Julie Eberton says to him, quote, you need to make sure you sign this. That's it. And I think if you look at those facts and you compare it to Zuber, the court should find that there's nothing procedurally unconscionable about that. There's nothing procedurally unconscionable about requiring an employee to sign agreement as a condition of employment. There's no coercion here. There's no forced time limitation, and there's no misrepresentation.
Counsel, let me ask you a question. Yeah. Why does this agreement, or I shouldn't say why, does the record tell us why the agreement refers to a statute that has since been repealed?
It does not.
Okay.
Yes.
How would an arbitrator decide what law to apply to this agreement?
I think start out by looking in the rules of the agreement itself. And you'd have to apply those rules.
You'd have to apply a statute that had been repealed.
Well, I would say, no, separate from the statute, and I think that is a great point. It's something for the arbitrator to decide. But fundamentally, you apply the arbitration as you apply the rules that are laid out in the arbitration agreement itself. They're very similar to the civil rules. Real quickly.
But you concede that that statute is no longer in effect.
Yes.
And I assume you would tell the arbitrator that.
Yes. I assume the arbitrator, being a retired judge, would be sophisticated enough to figure that
out.
Well,
even without that, you would disclose that.
Yes. Employees aren't the only ones who get to make public policy arguments, and Good Chevrolet has a good one here. Good Chevrolet treats its employees very well. The reason David Beer came to Good Chevrolet was an opportunity to make more money than he was making before. And he got a real benefit from coming to Good Chevrolet. And in exchange, Good Chevrolet wanted him to agree to an arbitration process that would give it some certainty and that could reduce litigation costs. And Beer got a benefit. Good Chevrolet got a benefit from that agreement. And Beer should not be able to back out from that now. As to the attorney issue, right to an attorney, I think the way I read that agreement, it's just a chance for both sides to save a little and not employ lawyers at the arbitration. And I think the agreement is unambiguous that you still get attorney fees because you're entitled to any remedy under the statute, and we would ask that this court reverse. Thank you.
Thank you.